Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. This morning, the London-based pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca announced more promising news about a vaccine for COVID-19. But before any vaccines are distributed widely, it's crucial that all of us continue mitigation efforts to control the spread of the virus. One of those efforts is contact tracing. 2 weeks ago, the Maryland State Department of Health launched Maryland COVID Alert, a phone-based system to notify people of possible exposure to the virus. Is it effective, especially at a time when COVID cases are surging? Does it compromise people's privacy? Today on Midday, Dr. Crystal Watson of the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security and Dr. Catherine Feldman, the director of the Contact Tracing Unit at the Maryland Department of Health, join me to talk about it. Plus, J. Wynn Russick has some tips for theater lovers about what to stream this holiday weekend. First, the news. Hey, everybody. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Hope you had a decent weekend. A third pharmaceutical giant, AstraZeneca, announced this morning that late-stage clinical trials of a COVID-19 vaccine in the UK and Brazil show more promising results. The London-based company joins the American companies, Pfizer and Moderna, in expressing confidence that an effective vaccine will be available soon. But in the meantime, the coronavirus continues to surge here in Maryland and across the country. The CDC is urging Americans not to travel and not to congregate with anybody outside their immediate household on Thanksgiving. People are also being encouraged to get tested for COVID, and although the state of Maryland has expanded the number of testing centers, people have had to endure long lines in recent days. At the Baltimore Convention Center, for example, they are testing 3 times the number of people every day that they were testing during the summer. 2 weeks ago, the Maryland Department of Health launched Maryland COVID Alert, a notification system for people who have been exposed to the virus. So far, more than 1 million Marylanders have subscribed to the system. Later this hour, I'll talk with Dr. Catherine Feldman about Maryland COVID Alert. She's the Maryland Health Department's chief public health scientist and the director of its contact tracing unit. But my first guest is Dr. Crystal Watson. She's a senior associate at the Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Earlier this year, as the pandemic was first taking hold, Dr. Watson co-authored a report for the National Association of U.S. Public Health Agencies that described what a comprehensive contact tracing program for the country should look like. Dr. Crystal Watson joins us now on Zoom. Hey, Dr. Watson, welcome back.
Hi, good afternoon, Tom.
So here's a question I'm pretty sure I know the answer to, which is, did the federal government take you up on your offer of a comprehensive plan for contact tracing that would be nationally implemented?
Yeah, unfortunately, no. We saw planning for testing. We saw a national plan for testing, but we never did see that national plan from the White House or from the agency level for contact tracing. CDC has put out a lot of great guidance on contact tracing, but we really haven't had the same push for this public health intervention as we have for testing, for example.
Have you been contacted by anybody in the Biden transition team? Do you have an inclination that the federal government's posture on this will change on the 20th of January with the new administration?
I've definitely seen the plans for the future Biden administration, and it does include a focus on contact tracing. I think they take up our original number of 100,000 contact tracers across the country, and that's kind of their goal. So I'm really supportive of what I've seen so far.
Is it too late for contact tracing? Is there such thing as so much community spread that contact tracing is somehow rendered ineffective? We've heard people say that the virus has spread so widely and so completely and so deeply into the country that it's impossible to trace everybody's contacts and origins of the virus.
Yeah, I don't think it's a zero-sum game. I don't think it's, is it working or not working? All contact tracing that we're doing, and especially that Maryland is doing, is helpful. I do think, though, that it can be quickly overwhelmed. It can't be the only tool that we have to control the spread of this virus. If the virus is spreading exponentially, we can't increase our contact tracing workforce exponentially in the same way. So there is a point where it becomes pretty overwhelming. And actually, the CDC has just put out new guidance looking at how to prioritize contact tracing resources if those systems do become overwhelmed. But it's not zero sum. It's not all or nothing. We should keep contact tracing even if we have lots of transmission and we're not able to control it just with the contact tracing.
And the guidance that the CDC has issued makes sense to you? Do you think they're doing a good job in that regard?
I do think so. I think health departments are having to make difficult choices about where they put their resources. And so rather than giving up on contact tracing, it's important that CDC has put out guidance on how to kind of target those resources and what priority population should be contact traced in order to continue this practice and make it as effective as possible, even amidst a very large surge of cases.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest, Dr. Crystal Watson. She's a senior associate at the Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health here in Baltimore. If you have a question for Dr. Watson, our number 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org, and to tweet us, it's @MiddayWYPR. Dr. Watson, should everybody get tested? Governor Hogan is encouraging that. His press spokesperson tweeted about it several times just over the last 72 hours. Should asymptomatic people get tested just so they know one way or the other whether or not they're positive?
I think we should build our testing capacity so that everyone can get a test when they need it. But we also shouldn't rely just on testing, especially as we come into Thanksgiving and I know people want to gather together. Testing is not really the answer there. You could test negative in the morning and become infectious in the afternoon. So it's not a foolproof way to kind of reduce your risk from COVID-19. But we do need to keep increasing our capacity. There are many different types of uses for testing, and we should make that available to when people need it.
The positivity rate here in Maryland as of this morning is 6.88%. It's almost 7%. There's an assumption, and there's been an assumption, as I understand it, since the beginning of the pandemic, that there's actually a lot more disease out there than positivity rates suggest. Is that a correct assumption?
I think positivity rate is not a perfect indicator. It does give us some idea, especially with the trend in test positivity, that an epidemic may be increasing and we're not testing enough to keep up with it. But it's not a perfect indicator. I don't think we're testing enough in our communities. And there is likely a lot more cases than we have detected so far.
But our capacity for testing is not yet up to where it needs to be. Is that what you're suggesting?
Like with contact tracing, the capacity needs to keep growing with the number of cases. And that's really hard to do, to keep up with the transmission. So, we need to keep increasing our capacity, but we also need to bring down transmission. We need to take collective action to stop the virus from spreading. And that's the things that we've been doing all along, staying home as much as possible, wearing a mask or face covering, keeping your distance from other people when you have to go out, and then policies from the state level and the national level to reduce the opportunity for transmission are really important, because we can't keep growing our capacity to exponentially. It just isn't going to work that way.
And the report that you issued, you and a few others issued this past summer, describe these concrete policy actions that the federal, state, and local governments should take. Summarize what those are. What should the government be doing at this point in the pandemic?
Yeah, I think especially at the state level, what our governor is doing now is increasing those restrictions on people going out and interacting in our communities, shutting down those environments that are really problematic for transmission, like indoor dining and bars, gyms, working out indoors. That's really important to control this current surge. And so, but in addition to that, the government needs to provide relief to the businesses that have to make these sacrifices so that we can bring down transmission. And so those are the two big things that I think our government should be focusing on.
So would it be your suggestion to the governor or to any mayor or county council or county executive in the jurisdictions throughout the state that there is a complete lockdown of bars, restaurants, movie theaters, churches, houses of worship, places where people gather indoors, gyms and fitness centers? I mean, should we lock it down now for a period of time to bring those positivity rates lower? Or can it be done with the kind of incremental closing that the governor is talking about? For example, forcing bars and restaurants to close at 10 o'clock at night because they found that after people have been in the bars for a little while and they've had a few drinks, the compliance rate plummets after 10 p.m. So his hope is that allowing the bars to stay open and restaurants stay open until 10 allows them to stay in business, but it also cuts down somewhat on community transmission. How do you see the proper balance between the economic impact and the public health impact?
Yeah, I think it really depends on what the epidemic looks like in the locality we're talking about. In Maryland, I understand the desire to take an incremental approach, but what we don't want to do is get to a place that we're seeing in other parts of the country where hospitals are overwhelmed and potentially collapsing under the surge in patients that they're seeing. So I think that it's smart to close these environments that are really, really problematic for transmission. The faster we do it, I think the less time we will have them closed. But I fear we will get there anyway with an incremental approach.
What's your top of mind worry? You're with the Center for Health Security at Johns Hopkins, at the Bloomberg School. What is keeping you up at night? And I assume something is keeping you up at night because almost everybody else is being kept up at night. So I assume you're part of that group too. I mean, what's top of mind about what you need to be doing at Hopkins and in the throughout the huge confederation of hospitals that Hopkins has here and around the country? And what's top of mind for the folks who are doing the kind of research that you're doing?
For me, it is really protecting hospitals is the top priority, because if we can't keep hospitals functioning at a reasonable level and keep our workforce okay, I mean, people are exhausted in public health and in healthcare right now from this year-long kind of marathon that we've had. And so if we can't protect them, not only will we lose more people from COVID who will be hospitalized, but we will lose more people who need to be in the hospital for other reasons, because we'll have to reduce the number of things reduce the care that can be provided in hospitals. And so that is my number one concern, that we keep hospitals from becoming overwhelmed. I'm really worried about the current surge we're seeing across the country and potential for a future surge if people really gather for Thanksgiving. I think that's a really scary thought. And so I really hope that people just take a second thought and decide to stay home and keep each other safe this Thanksgiving.
When you read reports of places like the Mayo Clinic in the Midwest having some 900 healthcare workers at the Mayo Clinic currently positive for COVID-19, is there a chance that that could happen here on the East Coast with hospitals like Johns Hopkins?
I think the Mayo Clinic is a top-rate institution, and so it's very worrisome to see the number of healthcare workers that have been exposed in that setting. So, yeah, I worry about it. We need to protect our healthcare workforce, because not only are they needed to treat COVID patients, but we're also putting them at some of the highest risk in our communities. And so we need to protect them and their families and make sure that they are also okay.
Are you satisfied or confident that when vaccines become available, in fact, they will be given to frontline healthcare workers first and then people in nursing homes? I mean, from what you know of the distribution plans for whatever vaccines are able to be manufactured quickly, are you satisfied that the plans make sense?
Yeah, I do think that prioritizing healthcare workers first, along with people who are in long-term care and nursing home facilities, who are on the front lines and then are also the most vulnerable to this virus, I think that makes sense, and I do think that's well represented in the current planning, both at the national and the state and local levels.
We have a question from a listener who says, when a vaccine is ready, will testing be a requirement to receive a vaccine? Do you have any idea about how that's going to work?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the planning around that. But we don't know a lot about immunity yet. So I think even if someone has had the virus, they may still be eligible for a vaccine. You probably don't want someone who's actively infected coming in to get vaccinated. But other than that, I think vaccination will probably occur regardless of whether someone has been infected.
The work that you all are doing about protecting the hospitals and the healthcare workers, are you satisfied that given where the trend for coronavirus transmission is heading here in Maryland, increasing on a daily basis, that we have enough beds, that we have enough frontline healthcare workers? There's a piece in the New York Times today about how there are enough ventilators around the country, but a big shortage of people who know how to operate the ventilators for those patients who are so sick that they require ventilation. In terms of Maryland, in terms of Hopkins, hospitals like, you know, University of Maryland, the local hospitals here in our state, what's your assessment of our readiness for a continued surge of the virus?
Yes, I'm most concerned about our healthcare workforce. I think our hospitals are preparing as best they can for a surge, but what we really need to do is protect them by reducing transmission, because these healthcare workers have been on the front lines of this for months and months. And not only are they, some of them getting sick and having to isolate or quarantine if they've been exposed, so they have a reduced workforce in some cases, but they're also just tired. And some of them are even getting out of healthcare because they're just so exhausted. So I do think we just need to protect them better by reducing transmission in our communities.
And Dr. Watson, one final question. What about schools? New York City is going through a very contentious argument now in the public sphere about its decision to close schools, a decision that they made because the positivity rate in New York hit 3%. That was a magic number that they came up with before they even opened the schools. And Mayor de Blasio in New York said, look, once it gets to 3%, we're going to close them again. That's what he's done. Now there's an outcry. When jurisdictions make these decisions and have these magic numbers they come up with, 3%, 5%, you know, the World Health Organization said, you know, it should be 5% before things get back to, you know, opening. New York just sort of decided 3%. When Governor Hogan has to make a decision about, you know, 25% capacity or 50% capacity in a restaurant or a bar, are we any better at coming up with what those magic numbers should be? And in schools in particular, because most of the jurisdictions here in Maryland have scaled back their plans to open up in-person learning, given the surge of the pandemic, what should be the guiding principles in that decision?
Look, I think these are really difficult decisions. There are no magic numbers, but we do have to make decisions. Leaders have to make decisions based on the data that they have. So it's a really tough call. I do think we should be prioritizing our kids and our schools and trying to get them back to in-person learning as much as possible. And if that means that we are prioritizing keeping schools open above other types of environments and businesses in our communities, I do think that that's what we should focus on. We're seeing in France now, they have kept the younger kids in school and have shut down businesses, indoor businesses where people gather, and they're having success at turning the epidemic around there. So I think we should take some lessons from that.
Yeah, there are paradigms out there, to be sure. Dr. Crystal Watson is a senior associate at the Center for Health Security at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Watson, thank you again. Always a pleasure to have you on, and a happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
Thanks to you as well.
Coming up next, we're going to take a closer look at Maryland COVID Alert, what it is, what it does, and how it can help. Dr. Catherine Feldman, the director of the Contact Tracing Unit at the Maryland Department of Health, joins us on the other side of this quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the program tomorrow, an homage to our fair city of Baltimore. There's plenty about Baltimore that drives us all nuts, but there's also a lot to be thankful for. And in this season of Thanksgiving, my guest will be Ron Cassie. He's a senior editor at Baltimore Magazine. He's just published a wonderful new book called If You Love Baltimore, It Will Love You Back. It's a collection of stories about some of the people and places that make Baltimore the funky and quirky and lovable place that it is. Ron Cassie will share some of his favorite Baltimore stories, and I hope you'll join us and share some of yours as well. That's tomorrow on midday. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about contact tracing. Ever since the beginning of the pandemic, it's been lauded as a powerful public health tool to help slow the spread of COVID-19. Dr. Catherine Feldman is the chief public health scientist and director of the contact tracing unit at the Maryland Health Department. 2 weeks ago, the department introduced Maryland COVID Alert, and already more than 1 million Marylanders have subscribed to the service. Dr. Feldman joins us now on Zoom. Doctor, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So explain to us how Maryland COVID Alert works.
Right. So this is a technology that one engages through their smartphone. So if you have a smartphone, you enable exposure notifications on your phone, and it uses Bluetooth to communicate with other phones that have also enabled the exposure notifications technology. And this allows two phones to constantly be exchanging random IDs, so it's all done anonymously. So if you're out and about and you spend a certain amount of time in close proximity to another smartphone, it's exchanging these random IDs that are then logged. And if down the line, one of those phones is used to report a COVID diagnosis, it will go ahead and alert the other phones that were within 6 feet for at least 15 minutes. So it's a way to let people know they've been exposed to COVID, even if you don't know who you might have been encountering in the course of your day.
And it is sophisticated enough then to separate out literally just walking past somebody who happens to be, you know, found to be COVID positive. I mean, if you pass somebody on the street or you pass somebody in the grocery store and you're not in proximity to that person for more than just a few seconds, this will discern to identify the people you've been in an enclosed area with or any area with for 15 minutes. It knows how to, it has a timer right on it.
Yeah. So the tech is quite sophisticated and beyond me, I'll be totally honest, but it has both a proximity and a time component. So it will be accumulating the time that the two phones are in proximity. And so it could be interrupted time as well. Could be 5 minutes now and then 5 minutes a little bit later and then 5 minutes later on to reach that 15-minute threshold. but all within the course of 24 hours. And that matches the CDC definition for what constitutes close contact that could result in COVID transmission. So we talk about a 6 feet and 15 minute threshold.
Does it distinguish between outdoor and indoor contact?
It does not distinguish between outdoor and indoor contact. And in fact, that's an important point I'd like to make, is that this is done all anonymously and doesn't use any location data. So it doesn't know where you are. It doesn't collect the location data. It doesn't know who you are. So it's all done with the intent of preserving privacy.
And let's talk about privacy. I have an iPhone, and this thing popped up and said, do you want to say yes to this? So there were two things I had to do. I had to say yes, and I had to make sure that my Bluetooth was engaged. And that's it, right, in terms of signing up for it. For iPhone users, there is no app to download even, right? But that is not quite the case for people who are using different operating systems. Explain what the differences are.
Right. So you just very nicely described what the experience would be on an iPhone. I am an Android user. And so what I had to do was be aware of this technology, the availability of it. Google is pushing out a notice, or has pushed out a notice to folks to make sure people in Maryland are aware of the availability of it. But then if you go to the Google Play Store and you search for MD COVID Alert, the app will pop up. This is an app developed by Google. So it's all Google developed technology. You download it. You enable exposure notifications within the app, just like you were describing for the iPhone, and you're off and running.
There have been reports about apps like this around the country getting off to pretty slow starts. A few days ago, the governor did announce that in the first couple of weeks since its introduction, Maryland COVID Alert has had about 1 million people sign up for it. How does that number strike you? Is that a really good number? Is that a number you'd like to see improve? Where does it stand on the spectrum of numbers you're going to be happy about?
Well, we are delighted by that number. We think it is absolutely great. Now, we would love to see it increase. You know, there are around 6 million Marylanders, and not all of them are over the age of 18. But if there's anyone who's 18 and over and has a smartphone, we'd encourage you to opt in to this technology. Now, just a point about why there might have been a slower rollout elsewhere. There have actually been a couple generations of this technology. And the first rollout that Google and Apple did required a public health authority to engage with a third-party app developer to create an app. And that just introduced some additional hurdles that needed to be crossed in order to implement the technology. This newer generation, what we're calling Exposure Notifications Express, really is much more simple to implement. And as you just very nicely described, it's all built into the operating system for an iPhone, and it's just a kind of a two-click process. And so by not having that middle third-party app developer, it was able to be rolled out and made much more simple for Maryland residents.
You've talked about this already, but I want to have you restate it or emphasize the privacy dimension of this. What, again, are the protections about personal information of the users being disseminated widely or even narrowly to tech companies, to government entities? Who collects this information to begin with? Who has it? And who might have access to it? And is there any danger of this information being misused and abused in a way that violates people's privacy?
Well, we certainly understand that people have concerns about privacy. This technology was developed expressly to be privacy preserving, and it doesn't collect any personal information from the user of the phone, and it doesn't track location. So those data are not collected, so they can't be then shared. And in fact, we don't know. So the way it works is you have your phone, you've opted into the technology. Later on, you're diagnosed with COVID. You can report your diagnosis through this technology. And then by doing that, it will trigger alerts to the other phones that were within 6 feet for at least 15 minutes. We don't know who those other phones are. We don't get any information about the people who go ahead and report their diagnoses. It's all done without having any idea of who the people are or where the exposure occurred. So when somebody gets the alert that they might've been exposed, they know the day that they were exposed, but they don't know where it occurred. They don't know anything else.
But if they are given the day of their exposure, in some cases, people might be able to intuit or figure out where it is they were exposed. And if someone gets that notification that says you've been exposed on such and such a date, which might have been a week ago, 2 days ago. Generally speaking, what's the time lag in between the ascertainment that exposure has occurred and the notification to people who've been exposed?
Right. There's certain time elements in there. So, very similar to the traditional contact tracing that is done. And I really loved how Dr. Watson described, needing additional tools to contact tracing. And so this is another tool, a complement to our traditional contact tracing. When a diagnosis is reported, the technology is smart enough to get the first date of symptom onset for that diagnosis. And then it goes back 2 days to identify any of the phones that were in close proximity from 2 days before the symptom onset date till the time of the report. And so knowing that there are lag times from the time somebody recognizes they don't feel well and goes and gets a test and then waits for that test result to come back, it can go back a week or so. But there's no point in going back more than 14 days because an incubation period for COVID is 14 days. So if you're past the 14-day window, it won't do any notifications.
And we have this question from a listener in Ellicott City who emails, is there a phone number I can call to get help setting up the COVID tracing app on my iPhone? When I try the instructions currently on the Department of Health's website, it doesn't match what I see on my iPhone.
There is a phone number, and I should know it off the top of my head, and I don't. So can I give you an email address? I will get that phone number for you.
You could do that, and then you can email us the phone number, and we will post it on our website.
Okay, I will do
but
that.
But I wonder, I'm no tech genius by any means, but David's question sounds like he was going on his computer to the website, to the health department website. This is something you can do on your phone without a computer in tandem, right?
Right. So first of all, you can go to our website, coronavirus.maryland.gov. And if you click on the additional COVID resources, that will get you to all of our the FAQs, frequently asked questions for MD COVID alert. Oftentimes challenges that are encountered with iPhones are that the most recent operating system isn't installed. It might even be downloaded, but it's not installed. So there's some very basic things that can be answered in our frequently asked questions or with the phone number that I am about to give you because I have retrieved it. So we do have a call center that can take questions like this, and 877-319-1525. Again, 877-319-1525.
877-319-1525. So that's the number that people can call for help getting the Maryland COVID app alert up and running on their phones. And we will, again, post that number on the Midday webpage. So if you don't have a pencil, you haven't written it down right now, you can come to that wypr.org/midday page and you'll have it there. So Dr. Feldman, if somebody is notified that they have been in the proximity of someone else who is positive for COVID-19 for 15 minutes within the last few days or at the most 2 weeks, what's their next move? What should they do?
So people who receive the alert are given the same guidance as people who are called by contact tracers. And so that's quarantine. You've been exposed, so you should stay at home for 14 days, stop going out and about in the community and risk spreading the disease. You should get tested And with the caveat that testing doesn't get you out of quarantine. If you test negative, it doesn't get you out of quarantine because people can develop disease over the course of 14 days. So if you're within your 14-day period and you get tested, say, on day 4, and you're negative, it doesn't mean that you won't turn positive on day 5, 6, 7, et cetera. And then finally, instructions on how to monitor yourself for symptoms, because, of course, knowing that you've been exposed, we want people to know what to look out for.
And what is the distinction between this program, Maryland COVID Alert, and contact tracing? This is not a replacement of contact tracing. This is an enhancement, a complement. Is it different and distinct from quote unquote normal contact tracing? And if so, how?
It is very much a complement, and it's another tool in our toolbox to help stem the spread of disease in the community. So it is by no means a replacement. And in fact, if people get a phone call from our contact tracers, and that would be with the caller ID MDCOVID or the number 240-466-4488, we want them to answer the call, because participating in this exposure notifications technology is not a replacement at all. So it is a complement. It fills some gaps. If you are out and about in the community and you might not know everybody you were within 6 feet for at least 15 minutes of in the course of your day, and then you're diagnosed, you're gonna provide names to the contact tracers. But if you didn't know the name of somebody that was at the next table at a coffee shop or something, then this will help fill those gaps. And this is also just an alternative path to reach people. So we hope people will participate in this, but we also urge them to cooperate when contact tracers call.
Because the surge of coronavirus in our state is certainly, it continues to be of great concern. We're at about 184,000 confirmed cases, 4,300 deaths. We have tested 4.1 million people as of today, but our testing positivity rate is nearly 7%. It's 6.88%. Dr. Catherine Feldman is the Chief Public Health Scientist and Director of the Contact Tracing Unit at the Maryland Health Department, and we'll have a link again to Maryland COVID Alert on our website. The number to call if you have questions, 877-319-1525. Dr. Feldman, thank you so much for your time, and happy Thanksgiving to you and your family.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, a break from the coronavirus as we check in with Midday Theater critic Jay Wynn Russick. She's got some suggestions as to what to watch to satisfy your theater itch. But before we go to a break, each week here on Midday, it is our practice to read the names of the people, who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 299 people in Baltimore are reported to have lost their lives to violence. City police have released the identity of a homicide victim whose death was first reported the week before last. He is Tavon Paul. He was 28 years old. Last week, 4 people were victims of homicide in our city. The identity of one of those victims has now been released. He is Glenn Gaughan Jr. He was 32 years old. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.